cracked the whip and set out on his long, strange trip while sugar plums were dancing in his tail.
Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting Community Access Radio in Winnipeg, CKUW 95.9 FM.
The following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives. Join us next week when the regular host will be back with a few new episodes of original programming.
Friday morning, folks. If it's Friday and it's 11 a.m., you're listening to Of No Fixed Address right here at University of Winnipeg, your community radio station, CKUW 95.9 FM. We have the coldest day of the year, and, you know, we can't not complain about our weather this year because it's been amazing, amazing fall. Mm-hmm. We still don't have snow, but it is minus 6 out there right now. And it's not getting warmer. I think tonight's going down to minus 9, it says here. Excuse me, and maybe some snow tomorrow. Let's hope not. But as we always say, be kind. If you're going to Tim's, buy an extra cup of coffee. If you're going to Starbucks, buy an extra cup of coffee. If you can afford to go to Starbucks and buy one for $5, you can afford to go to Starbucks and buy two for $5. Do it. Today we have a very interesting guest on the show, Michelle Dahlman.
Hi, good morning.
I met her during the point in time count on the weekend or last week, and you know, she was a volunteer and doing surveys which is very, very important to find out what the numbers are on our streets and approximate numbers, so you know the federal government can know how much to what the numbers are to work with. Michelle, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Not chilly now that I'm inside.
Yeah,
I'm
for sure. You know, Michelle's and I had a good conversation as I like to have with all of my guests on the show about, you know, who they are and what brings them to where they are today. And, you know, I know you have some very interesting thoughts on our topic today, which is poverty, right?
Yeah,
and just if you whatever you care to share about your history, about your life, that I know you are very passionate about working with people who are underprivileged. Just whatever you care to share about your life in that regard.
Yeah, I guess something that drew me to the point in time count is just the fact of being a born and raised Winnipegger. I know that the heart and soul of Winnipeg is in the people, and as someone who has lived downtown and in West Broadway and has taken an education downtown and in the inner city, it's been striking to me to see the opportunities that I've been given and that the people that I've learned with have been given, and to see the opportunities that have been lost by so many people just by way of they're experiencing or being forced to experience poverty and homelessness in the city. And so I guess just my education and my passion really comes from a love of the people here and a love of the passion that the people in the city have for each other. And that was a big thing that drew me to the point in count, and then also just the pursuit of abolishing poverty in the city and in Manitoba as a whole. Which,
yeah, and, you know, we are very much a have-not province, you know. And I think, you know, it's visible on the street. It's, you know, I think the only place in Canada that's more visible than Winnipeg is probably, is Vancouver, downtown east side. And, you know, we're talking homelessness, but the hidden trauma is in poverty.
Yeah.
And you see so many people that just struggle with everyday life, and that carries a lot of trauma.
Totally. Like, the violence of poverty is something that not a lot of people, I think, have a deep and meaningful understanding of, or they have such an understanding of the violence of poverty that they have either experienced it or they have seen it to the point where they are, like, physically averse to it, where they are, like, scared of the fact that the experience of the violence of poverty could be them next. And I think that, yeah, you're right when you say, like, for our province, we as people, I think, are forced to have not by a lot of decisions that are being made at a provincial level and at a city level and at the federal level as well.
Yeah, you know, a really, really telling fact was, like, I was part of, you know, Make Poverty History, and I'm still kind of on. I don't attend that many meetings, but I'm still part of the steering committee there.
Love Make Poverty History.
But you know, they filed a report, and I joined the very day that they published their report on poverty in the city, and you know, it was turned over to the city and all, and we got the poverty reduction strategy going, and I have a side story to that. I had to really, really beat up on Noel to pop on getting people with lived experience around the working tables.
Yeah, that's
because
challenging.
Because they had people in River Heights living in million-dollar homes on the poverty reduction strategy team, but they didn't working team, but they did not have anybody with lived experience of poverty. And I said, how can you have somebody who hasn't even sniffed poverty for a day in their lives and not have people who lived the experience of poverty?
Yeah.
So now we have three. We had three before they disbanded everything. But the really telling piece of this is that the city totally disbanded the poverty reduction strategy team and took away all the money. Give them zero money. And
impoverished the poverty reduction team.
They did. That's exactly what they did. And dispersed you know, people to the fire department and to other departments within the city in different roles. And they just do not understand the travesty of poverty. Why would they take it? You know, again, they have a problem with taking it away from the least of these, right? Or the people that are the most vulnerable, the areas that are most vulnerable, they take money away from that. Another good example is of a lack of understanding, lack of compassion, lack of empathy is taken away from the community grant program and then having so much backlash that they actually have to reinstall it.
I
don't understand our politicians sometimes.
I want to say sometimes, like, I might say that, like, when people with the power to make decisions about how others are forced to run their life, when they make decisions that take away from the most vulnerable communities, I think a lot and part of that is based in, like, not just misunderstanding, but a shame of that misunderstanding, right? When you have, and I don't think we should give too much leeway, but I think it's important to understand that, like, people who take away from others do so because it's easy. It's easy to take from community initiatives and to take from community grant programs. And it's easy to say, we need this housing and you deserve this housing, but it's easier for us to not fund it because it is challenging to say that to decide that people are deserving of security.
Yeah.
And I think that is.
And the whole thing is they have a $350 million police budget.
Boy, do they.
I'm sure they could have taken a dollar or two away from, or any other, but not on the programs. So you have a $5 million community grant program, and they take $2 million away.
Did you know that $5 million is actually like the salary for 78 new officers? $5 million for an incredible community grant program is the salary of only 78 police officers.
Right.
And like the impact of that money goes so much farther when it comes to the community grant programs than it would
for
with
sure.
only 78 officers.
And then and again, you also have the provincial government in their wisdom. And they have a humongous budget taken away from the Canada Manitoba housing benefits and putting people in a very precarious position to lose their housing or not being able to get housing. And so, again, because of outcry, they put it back in for an extra 500 people who are on the waiting list. And so, but that's going to end then as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, my group of, you know, we're dealing with the National Anti-Poverty Fund, which is privately funded. We're going to address the Canada Manitoba housing benefit for the next 3 years after that. And how you know, it seems like we should be able to shame governments into doing the right thing because they're not capable of doing the right thing.
I think
they really aren't.
I think also there is like when it comes to, again, like the powers, like the legally, like let's think about legislation, right? And regulation. I think importantly, when we think about the cost of housing, what level of government does that fall under? It's the provincial government, right?
It falls under all three, but the city is very limited.
Yeah, exactly. But and mostly it does fall under, like, we get help from the federal government, but mostly regulation is under the provincial government. And so we think about when we think about the housing benefit being losing money, that's government money that is basically going straight to landlords because there is a lack of regulation on the cost of housing. And so there's not really the ability for renters. And when we say housing, I think importantly, we should remember, like, it's not just the cost of, like, there's a house, but a lot of people who are experiencing poverty, the working class, we are renters. And so it's the cost of renting.
Yep.
And so the regulation, a lack of regulation on the cost of rent, it's government money that is being wasted, what people would say, going towards landlords when people just want to be able to afford to live. And I think a solution there, honestly, is to act it within your power as a provincial government and say, we can regulate the cost of rent to be affordable per
they
person.
Can. They
fully.
Can.
It's fully within their power.
And, you know, I think there needs to be an overhaul of some sort within the RTB. you know, the whole thing is, I'll give my landlord as an example. Every time, they redid the concrete in the parking lot and wanted to jack up the rent by 18.9%. 18.9%. We finally had to go to RTB and we finally got them down to 15, but even that was way too high.
15.
And then when the RTB says you can have a 3% increase, they go for 7 and they get 4.5.
Because they'll get away with 4, yes.
Because they can get away with it. And I think there's something really, really wrong when the RTB
does. Where's the T in the RTB, baby? Like, come on.
when the RTB grants 1.5 points above what is regulated, there's something wrong with the system.
Oh, completely.
And you know, they try to get away so much. And I love my building manager. She's great. She's got a big heart. She's an empath, and she keeps people in way longer than she should and gets heat from above. And her and I have conversations that I help her out with different agencies that I can direct her to, because she says, who can I get to help this person because she cares, right? But it's, you know, the big big bosses in Calgary that come down here all the time. And, you know, not that long ago, they put out $500 million for 1,500 units in Calgary. And a third of those were low income that were going to be changed into market housing, right? The system is really bad right now, and I hate the fact that RTB allows people to go, the landlords to go above the regulated increase that the province has dictated.
And then I think, like, if you've ever been through the RTB process as well, like the and so let's talk about that, right? Like, you have renters who are, again, often working one full-time job, two full-time jobs, families with children who are in school. RTB is available during working hours, right? So we're talking 9 to 5. When do you guys work, right? Like, it is, well, again, it is not created for the tenants. It is created to be accessible for the people to essentially weaponize the system against the working class people.
And again, a lot of folks are on welfare too, right?
Exactly.
And, and Deb's heard me tell this story many times. We took an apartment because we had to, and it was 80% of our income. 80% of our income on welfare with water and hydro, right? And drafty windows where a hydro bill is $250 a month in winter.
Oh my gosh.
And we couldn't pay any of that. So we got 3 or 4 months behind, they evicted us. And one of the things that people do to delay the process is go through the mediation process. But again, people just do it to extend their stay until they find someplace. You know, cause that's what I, the only reason why I did it was to extend by 30 days. And so, but everybody knows that, you know, if you're a minute late or a dollar short, you're going to get kicked out. And so, of course, that happened. And the problem was we had a really nasty landlord. Actually, the building manager traveled around between buildings for them. And he was screaming at tenants all the time and used profanity with tenants all the time. And we asked to stay until we could get our next apartment 2 days later, but he refused. So we spent 2 nights in the back of a burnt-out garage with Char with her schizophrenia and PTSD and our 2 cats. And because he wouldn't let us stay with our furniture. You know, like, how nasty is that? He had a right to do it, I guess.
Well, and then the idea of, like, those power dynamics, right? Like, you are a person. You are, first off, you're a person. Like, let's quickly, like, humanize the fact that you are an individual, and everybody who lives is an individual. And I know that's, like, that could come across as hippie shit, but, like, but it is. Like, you are a person. And I think maybe that's where we are often lost, where we lose the fact of the power dynamic and that you are a person who becomes vulnerable because you are dependent on the fact of that power. Like, you, again, like, by charter rights, you are deserving of security to your life.
Right there in the Constitution.
But I want to maybe, because you brought up the idea of welfare, and I think something that comes up a lot is, like, people hate, people, again, like, the disgust of at the violence of poverty. People are disgusted at the idea that people are dependent on quote-unquote government handouts. But, again, like, regulation of the cost of rent will reduce the cost of welfare, will reduce the dependency on welfare, and then on top of that, you one of the things that gets brought up a lot is, like, GDP or economy. How do we save our economy? You make sure that the money that people are making stays with the people who want to spend that money. Because if $1,000, if 100% of my paycheck, 80% of your paycheck is going towards landlords who are keeping that money, I am losing my housing. I'm losing my ability to pursue my education, my career, my interests, my the things that make me a person secure in my life and my liberty. And I become homeless, right? And so, again, it's kind of like, if you want to save the economy, if you want to grow your money within the country and within the province, there needs to be immediately or as soon as possible a cost regulation of the of rent, of rent.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. And I think, like, and then also maybe just to, like, go a little bit off on that one as well. I think when you regulate the cost of rent, you then stop creating biases and you stop creating the stereotype that is so hateful and vulgar towards people who experience poverty. And, like, there's a lot of legislation I see and a lot of programs that perpetuate poverty, that are a trap for people in poverty. And I think that that is, like, again, fully, it is fully within the control of government powers to regulate
poverty. I had a meeting one time with a couple of people from Make Poverty History, with a then minister of welfare and our former premier Stephenson. We were in our office, and so I brought up the fact that you know, for people to get a bus pass at that time, they had to go to see a doctor four times a week or have some sort of provision for it. And I said, you know what that would do if everybody did that, what that would do to the budget of the WRHA? It would kill it.
Yeah.
It would kill it.
Oh, what waste.
And the doctors, to get people bus passes, had to actually lie in their letters to welfare, to EIA, to get people bus passes.
Yeah.
And, you know, her answer was, yeah, well, we do a lot of things that don't make sense sometimes. You know?
Why do them then? You know? Why do things that are nonsense, especially if they're going to honestly destroy? And, like, people think poverty just affects the people living on the streets or just the people who are precarious. But, like, again, I want to go back to the fact that I love Winnipeg so much and the people in Winnipeg and the love that we have for each other and the support and the community. You know that organizations are networking with each other to make sure that we all have what it is that we need to thrive and be exactly who it is that we deserve to be within our city and within our province. Why do things that don't make sense when it makes sense to do things that do?
Entirely. Like, and that was one of the weirdest answers I've ever heard.
Yeah. You know? And you're...
It was a leader of the people, yes,
ma'am.
Yeah, and at that time she was in charge of welfare. And, you know, one of the other things that really, really bothered me was the fact that, you know, CERB payments. And I'm in the minority here because I feel that when you're living in a demeaning life of welfare, of EIA, you need something to grasp onto. And, you know, for the $2,000 a month that people were able to receive, even though they were ineligible, that some people did receive, I was okay with that. You know, in BC, the whole difference is between different provinces. In BC, they got to keep the entire. If you're on welfare, you got to keep the $2,000 a month for a year or as however many payments you got. In Ontario, with that really oppressive PC government, they got to keep half. They got to keep half. In Winnipeg,
okay, so they had to, like, what you're saying is they got what they got and then they had to return some?
Yeah.
Okay.
They just took it away from your welfare payments.
Oh, off of welfare.
Yeah.
Okay,
and,
I see.
In BC, you got to keep everything. In Manitoba, you got to keep your 30%. Why did Manitoba not allow them to, you know, be humane about things?
Yeah.
You know, take on a human aspect of humanitarian aspect and let people keep the money. But nope, we had to claw it back, right? And then what happened is that people got cut off welfare while they're, you know, or they got cut off welfare till they got cut up. And so some people had zero income for 4, 5, and 6 months until they finally realized that they're putting people on the street way faster than they actually thought. Yeah. Where was the foresight in not seeing that with people having no income?
Yeah.
They're going to get kicked out, right?
Yeah.
And
I would
so
say,
like, I just felt that we could have been a lot more humanitarian.
Yeah, but I think we kind of, like, with a lot of our social assistances, and historically, a lot of our social assistances do act punitively, right? Like, you cannot make more than $200 without being punished immediately.
Exactly.
But when you apply for social assistance, it's based on, like, a year's previous documents versus, like, and so we act very austerically when it comes to people trying to come off of social assistance. We act very, unfortunately, those are the decisions, but I think that's another thing that definitely needs to be looked at, and
it does too. I won't say it on air, but I'm going through a process right now within the system, and boy, the urge to change the system with a massive lawsuit is really rolling around in my head. And I don't pay for legal fees, so I've been speaking to some lawyers about this, and because I don't, we could go on for a year and sue the pants off them, and at least their legal fees would be really, really high. but we need to
at
change.
Least someone's making
we
money.
We need to change the system, and it's not going to be changed by appealing, because the appeal board does nothing for you. You know, and so I am really, really, really right on the cusp of, you know, launching this massive lawsuit against the system.
He's coming for you.
You know, if you're living in the same place with the person, even though you're not a spouse, not a partner, you know, you fund a person, you give a personal allowance every month for years, and it's time that person actually has their own income, but they say no, because you live in the same place, you cannot. She cannot come off and go back on welfare. She cannot go back on welfare. And so this person has no chance of ever receiving any work because she has psychiatric issues. Mm-hmm. And yet the person that's funding is being punished to the tune of $70,000 over the last 6 years. Mm. You know, there's something really wrong with that when they're asking other people to take up their responsibility. And there's a real precedent set here in other provinces where people want suits against the system because of, and I think now it's not only the $60,000-$70,000, but it's like punitive damages. Let's make them really rethink about the system. Let's give them a $50 million lawsuit. Let's uproot the whole entire system. Mm. And I think that we need to do something to change it because it is totally an unfair system. You know, how can you depend on a person who's not a spouse to actually pay a person's way?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Definitely, I think especially contemporarily, we need to be looking at what it means, what human relationships look like.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
A lot of our policies and regulations and laws are based on we kind of were coerced into an idea of traditional relationship standards,
right,
which is what a lot of our legislation is rounded on.
The whole thing is, I pulled Char out of the Salvation Army 12 years ago, right? She'd been in there for 9.5 years because of schizophrenia and PTSD and couldn't speak and couldn't communicate and all that. And after 3 months, they deemed us to be a couple when we really, really weren't. You know, she was my friend.
Yeah, I feel like you should be able to consent whether or not you're dating someone.
Yeah. She was my friend, and that was it, right? And soon I became her caregiver, right? I became her caregiver.
Yeah.
That was it, her best friend and her caregiver.
Oh, we could
and
get so, into the idea of, like, emotional labor and unpaid labor people do when they are just... And, like, the idea of, like, establishing and maintaining community and care of community members... yeah, there's so much to go into.
Yeah, there
with
is.
That.
Folks, you're listening to Norfolk Address, your community radio station, and your advocacy radio show right here at 95.9 CKUW FM. We're going to take a brief music break, but stay tuned to come back. We'll continue this animated discussion on poverty and the broken down system that we have currently.
that girl. We should have been together. It could have been forever. We shouldn't be apart, but I broke her heart. Pieces of honey.
And you're back with your host, Al, on of No Fixed Address right here at CKUW 95.9 FM, your community radio. I always have trouble saying community. Your community radio station right here at the University of Winnipeg. Right now, we have, it was minus six with the wind chill. I think minus nine. We're actually starting to get into wind chill stuff now. minus six and going down to minus nine tonight. Or minus five now. It's gone up a degree. But, you know, it's uncomfortable and it's starting to kind of, I guess we're going to having flurries right now. I know when I walked in, it was just a little bit, but I dread the snow. And, you know,
the following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives.
Any little bit of moisture is horrible.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be rain, whether it be snow, it sticks to your bones and you never warm up. And you can only stay in shelters and places so long before they kick you out.
It's not even like they have heated bus shacks anymore.
That's right. They don't have heated bus shacks anymore either. And speaking of the homeless issue, we just completed our, I think it was our fifth. This was our fifth homeless memorial service. No, our fifth biannual point in time count or street census, if you care to call it that, that the federal government mandates every 2 years. This is going to be last one for 3 years, and in 3 years we're going to have another one and continue in a little bit different format. But we did it over 4 days this year, which I think the consensus was that it was a little too many days, and you know, maybe 2 days might have been better because it just leads to a whole bunch of duplication. And people see those blue vests coming, everybody wore the blue vests, and it was really, my particular area, I asked for a lot of responsibility, and I actually got a lot of responsibility because I was the neighborhood coordinator for both the core area and downtown. So I had 11 routes to send people and out to. And at times it got kinetic because we had when people came in to start to go out, I also had people coming in who had done surveys. So at one point in time, we had 42 people in the building at the same time, and we had to coordinate them in and out and process them and all the chaos. But it was a lot of fun. You know, I was really happy that In Homelessness Winnipeg had three or four staff members in the room to help me with that. Otherwise, it would never happen. But again, Michelle, you were a volunteer for this as a surveyor, and I do really appreciate that. And we did have roughly 200 this year, and I think it wasn't quite enough. But you know, we need to do this, and people, you know, kind of put up a fuss about it, and why are you wasting money on this? But the problem is, and sure, there's that aspect too, but the problem is we need numbers to give to the federal government for funding. Our Reaching Home program, which is the federal government, the name of the federal government's program that funds homelessness and housing, at the end of 2025 is going to be cut by 75%.
Of course.
Which is criminal, actually.
Yeah.
And when I was in Ottawa at the Canadian Alliance on Homelessness Conference, I spoke to Reaching Home and some of the directors there, and they said, well, we're going to do something different, but we don't know what it looks like yet. That's really comforting. You know?
I have an idea of a plan.
It was like really not a comforting, answer, because it's going to put so many service providers out of work. They're going to put you know, case managers out of work because you're no longer able to afford them. And as a vice chair of community advisory board, and we tell In Homelessness of Winnipeg where to distribute the money to and who to give it to, it's going to make our life really, really miserable, because what can you do with 25% of what used to be 100%? You know, it's not going to work to any degree whatsoever. And I fear that day, and I fear what's going to happen right across the country to the homeless numbers. But, you know, again, the point in time count is all about giving the federal government numbers and reasons why people are on the street. Yeah. And again, we run into what's the word we use for rent eviction, or what's it called?
Which ones? Yeah, there's many different.
Yeah,
things.
Yeah.
Landlords are like evicting for so many different reasons.
There's
rent evictions.
Yeah, rent evictions. I think that's the word I'm looking for, or the term I'm looking for. But you know, you have people on the streets because of mental health. We have people on the streets because of
relationships.
Addictions, and again, the cost of groceries and housing these days. I get nauseous going to the grocery store myself, and it's horrible. But talk to me a little bit about your experience and meeting folks on the street, because one of the things that is good to hear as a neighborhood coordinator. But again, there's a negative to it. People come back and say, "Wow, what a great experience! What a great experience! I'm so happy that I went. I met such very nice people." Mm-hmm. And my thing is, I don't ever say this, but I say, "I'm so glad to hear that." And people just want to go back and back and back. And my answer to that is, or question to that is, why was it so pleasant for you?
Yeah.
Because you were expecting something lesser than from the people that you're interviewing, right? And we carry our unconscious biases with us. And the good part about this, about the point in time count is that it does open people's minds to who the homeless are. And that for me, that's probably the greatest thing that comes out of this, because people actually see people for who they are, right? And not these monsters on the street or anything.
I think, like, maybe one of the things we might not have the time to get into this is, like, the idea of altruism. And so when you say, like, what are caseworkers going to do with 20%? Like, people who get into the work, like a point in time count or, helping people who are struggling with the experience of addiction or, abuse, just all the trauma that comes from being alive, right? Like, no one is born into this world thinking, I'm going to be in pain by the time I'm 22, right? We don't come into this world thinking that our life is going to become the way that it becomes when it becomes the worst it's ever been. And one of the things that I think I could recognize when people say this was such a good experience is not just, that it feels good to be out and, interacting with people that otherwise so many people who were volunteers may never have interacted with by choice. Except for the volunteerism part of it.
Right.
I think also, like, the fact of the possibility of the impact of the information that you gather is also something that adds to the pleasure of asking people, why are you here? Why are you forced to be sleeping in the streets? What do you need to maintain permanent, stable housing? Yes. I think that, hearing these answers, and for me it was confirmation of what I've experienced and what I've known already. And I think a question might be like, what as volunteers can we do with the information that we've gotten from these people in our greater life?
For me, the other good part about this is that you could tell them that your voice is being heard. This is your voice speaking. This is you speaking to the federal government directly, right? And I think that is really, really important that, again, the questions kind of narrow what you could can answer, but at least, it's coming from them, right?
Yeah. I might kind of push back on that a little bit, just because, like, some of the people that I actually did survey are people who I have spoken to for about a decade. I've seen the same people sleeping in the streets for, and this is not an exaggeration, like I said, like, I'm a downtown girl. This is my city. This is my hood. I surveyed people that I recognize and I've recognized yep. for the better part of the last. So when yes. we say like your voice is being heard, to have the person that you're speaking to surveying say, mm-hmm. okay, but this is like the third, this entirely. Is the third survey I've filled out. That's I've entirely. Seen this vest before
yep.
and not this year.
You I know? Totally agree with you.
I think like, it, yeah, in the challenge of, you know, thinking about altruism and charity and, mm. you know, when we think about research and the impact of research, there's such a thing as, like, research fatigue, mm. where you ask the same community the same questions over and over and over again. And, yep. you know, it's the same with the research is out there mm. where you want poverty to stop existing. You give right. people homes. Yep. You ensure that, mm. you know, we don't cut 75%. We make sure that mm-hmm. jobs exist. We fund the jobs mm-hmm. that are most impactful to mm-hmm. provide long-term future mm-hmm. Development for members yeah. beyond just like the individuals working with people experiencing addictions and poverty.
Sure.
It's a whole cycle, right? And I kind of lost my train of thought with that.
No worries. But you know, I spent 14 and a half months in Salvation Army 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And I still see people that are still living there mm-hmm. 12 years mm-hmm. later. There are some people who are lifers, you know, and they'll never get oh. out. And you know, we have to acknowledge that some people will never get off the street.
I refuse to acknowledge that. I want to be really yeah. honest. I think that choosing to acknowledge the mm-hmm. idea that some people will never get off the mm-hmm. street is baloney, if I censor myself. I think that takes away from the responsibility, the culpability yeah. of policymakers and policy mm-hmm. decision makers who yeah, say, I don't think we can do this, and then are killing people by their bad decisions.
Yeah, my whole question is, okay, this is my standard stock answer, and yeah. I've taken a lot of heat. Okay, if you could have ended homelessness, why didn't you do it 50 years ago when the class would have been so much less? Mm-hmm. If we could end the homelessness, why didn't you do it 10 years ago when End Homelessness Winnipeg started on their 10-year plan? Mm-hmm. Now they're on their second 10-year plan, mm-hmm. and their numbers are exploding mm-hmm. and going up and up and up.
Inflation.
I said, why did you not end it last year if you could have?
Yep.
You know,
all the
simply
buildings.
Because there's never enough political will to do that. And, you know, never. There's never enough political yeah. will to do. And it doesn't happen without political will. It doesn't happen without private sector funding. Mm. And none of those things ever come together at the same time.
And I think it all, again, like comes down to a fear and a disgust of mm. the idea of poverty, that it could be anyone, that like my business is suffering because, ew, people are poor. Ew, people are homeless, kind of thing. And there's mm-hmm. like they work together to, you know, try to move. We see the encampments, mm-hmm. but we'd rather move the encampments to a different
yeah,
neighborhood
exactly.
than accept
well,
that
NIMBYism.
They exist and people there are in need of support and help.
Good old NIMBYism. And, you know, one of the mm-hmm. other problems is our federal government. They put together this multi-billion dollar accelerated housing fund, which is only, it's that feed the middle class and it'll trickle down. Mm-hmm. 80% of market housing is what they consider affordable, which is no good to anybody. Mm. That needs to be housed from the street. It'll never happen. You know, downtown, 80% of income is 1,000. 80% of market is roughly $950, I think it is. And how in the world are we ever going to house people
no.
when this is what the federal government deems affordable?
Well, and then especially right? like yeah. to consider, like, are we basing the affordability on what landlords are saying the cost mm. of housing is,
yeah.
right? Like, and then you couple that with severely inadequate wages, minimum mm-hmm. wages,
yes.
right? Again, the majority of people are working minimum wage, are begging mm-hmm. to be paid enough to
yeah,
pay their rent,
mm-hmm.
yeah, enough to barely get by, right?
Yeah.
And then whatever livable wage they might mm-hmm. be able to scrape together working multiple
yeah.
jobs is 100% again going straight towards the landlords who
yeah.
say this is the cost of
yeah,
housing.
Exactly.
And then we base the cost of affordability off of what the landlords have said mm-hmm. is the cost of housing.
Mm-hmm.
So my idea, and I want to put this out there before we carry on, is like the cost of housing needs to be regulated per person or per room, like $400 per person or $400 per sleepable room. And it doesn't have to be forever. Let me just say it doesn't have to be forever. It can be regulated for an amount of 5 years. One provincial government's term would be enough to bring people off out of homelessness and into the economy and create a community which is able to thrive more than just barely survive.
Yeah, right now, we cannot pull people off the street because the housing is not there. And if we do, we had an incident a year ago where one of the housing providers put people in room in apartments without power, without water. We can't have that stuff happen, right?
Oh, and to
and
fix
you know,
that.
Again, you know, we have one champion of livable income, and that's Leah Gazan. And I'm really happy to, every time they have a barbecue out, and I'm out there preaching minimum income with Leah, and actually your daughter is always there as well. But you know, it's so complex. But you know, there's not enough political knowledge or will. And in 2 weeks' time, I'm going back in front of policy writers on homelessness for the federal government. I get to spend 4 hours with them. Yay! What that'll do, I don't know. But at least we're getting a bug in their ear about it, right? And somebody, you know. It's just we need the federal government to think totally differently than the way they do. And a couple of years ago, a couple of terms ago, they had a housing budget, and since then they've lopped it off and gone backwards, and it's gotten worse instead of better. So we just need maybe a change at the top. And
I think you mentioned like a lack of political awareness of. What's going on just as a whole, because there's so many facets that go into the fact of poverty and the violence of poverty. And I think one of the things that I want to emphasize is, I mean, for listeners and for anyone who's going to hear this now and in the future, is that there's like there's a bit of privilege in being politically involved. There is a privilege in access to being educated enough, or access to the internet, which is our only way of getting political information. And there's another idea, like, of what might be called like an epistemic injustice, where people who have been for so long forced into being experiencing the impact of policy rather than being impacted by policy. A lot of people do not feel like they deserve to know or that what they could know will have any impact. So again, when we go back to, when we say to the people that we're surveying, your voice is going to the federal government, the privilege of us as volunteers to speak to people and say, we are hearing you and we are going to pass this off to people who have had the privilege of being where they are to make these decisions, which are going to inevitably either save or kill the people that we've spoken to. There is, and I think that's something that needs to be recognized. And again, if I want to go back to maybe talking about shame again, it is embarrassing to be so privileged that you can choose whether or not people's lives are ended with a with a policy. I think that's really important to recognize when we speak to politicians. It's like, you're so lucky to be here.
And politicians who say, well, we do things that are illogical. But
my
folks,
$31 million.
Do you have any last words for our audience as we close this off today?
Thank you for having me. I want to say thanks to everybody who has taken the time to listen. And if there is a point in time where you feel like you are able to give your time, Reach Out Make Poverty History is a fantastic organization that does a lot of work to educate people. And there are so many organizations. Don't forget to donate to your local radio station.
Yes. We have Fun Drive coming up in January. So, thank you for that too.
So great to be here.
And the folks, again, it's -5 right now. It's going to drop to -9 tonight, I think, and perhaps a sprinkling of snow. But again, be kind. Buy an extra steep tea, extra coffee. If you could, McDonald's coffee is only a buck. You can afford to buy two coffees.
Have a conversation, man. Like, humans are humans. Yes. Speak to a person. Give them a hug. Hold a hand.
That's the other thing. Don't make people invisible. They call homeless folks invisible for a reason, because people walk by them and do not say a word. But next week, we may probably won't be on next week live, but the week following, I'm looking to have RaiseTheRoof.org on the air, and they just opened up a new facility with I think 15 rooms or something for folks to come out of the cold,
right,
over on Mountain and McGregor this week actually, and I met another volunteer. I met Michelle at the Point in Time Count. I also met Shoshana Kuden, ironically, whose grandfather was my childhood doctor. She's the comms person for Raising the Roof in Winnipeg. And, she's going to be on in 2 weeks' time, at least. And another really a great organization that I've never even come close to having on air. But, you know, we kind of got connected during the – that was one of my great pleasures of being in the neighborhood coordinators, meeting all these new people, right? And having communication with them. And so it was really, really good. But anyway, come back next week, and we'll have some really interesting show on. We have about a million to choose from. So over the last seven years now, that's incredible.
Play this one again.
eight years in May, I think, or April. But anyway, come back next week and stay tuned to CKUW. And take care.
Love
be
you.
Warm and be kind.